The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. England make it 3 wins from 3, but the real story is Scotland 3-0 up and most probably through before capitulating and conceding an equaliser in the cruelest of ways, as VAR is both absolutely right and completely wrong at the same time, while the ref clearly has somewhere to be at the end. Elsewhere, France are the other beneficiaries of a keeper being a centimetre off her line, and Sam Kerr scores 4 as Australia get going. In the Euro under-21s, Hamza Chowdhury and Aaron Wan-Bissaka put their feet in the wrong place as England turned victory into defeat against France. Brazil draw with Venezuela in Copa America. Platini's arrested, Monk is sacked, and Boya somehow stays at Charlton. We'll do all that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Debutant Floyd Lloyd Hughes is here, sports journalist from Women in Sport. Flo, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming.
No worries, thanks for having me.
Mark says, how was Barry's vacation? Did he help deliver any cows?
I did not help deliver any cows. And my holiday was okay, yeah, it was pretty quiet.
Did you say hello to Ma and Pa Glendenning?
Of course.
Okay. How are the Glendennings? It's been, we have mentioned that you don't phone them enough, so.
What, but you think I would go and visit them but not say hello?
I just wondered if they were pleased to see you.
I just barreled into the house, dinner now.
When it's your 14-year-old.
Right, I'm going out.
Andrew says, I always assumed...
It was like that on day 3.
Did they say, where are you going with your life? Have you met anyone nice?
Yeah, some of those.
When am I going to have some grandkids?
Kind of questions may have been asked.
Okay.
And what my mum does is wait till I'm vulnerable and hungover when she's driving me to the station, generally early in the morning, so I'm locked in the car, no escape, and then the interrogation begins.
Andrew says, I always assumed from his voice that Paolo was a Yanis Varoufakis-style tall and bald sex symbol. I come to find out he looks more like the lead singer of a Sunday school choir. Can he explain this?
I am quite tall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea. The ideas people get about you just from listening to your voice. I had someone come up to me once and say, oh, I thought you were like a salty 50-something. And I wasn't sure whether to take that as a good thing or a bad something. Bad thing. I'm not in my 50s yet. A little way off.
Salty is a real insult now, I believe.
Oh.
Flo, you're young. You're young. Salty, is that a...
Yeah, salty is sort of, you're a bit mean.
Hmm.
Yeah, you're a bit nasty.
Oh, well, you're not salty, Paolo, is it?
I come across.
If the opposite is peppery, peppery Paolo you are. Right, Argentina 3, Scotland 3. Flo, I was so angry at the end of this. Even if VAR was right, I was still angry about it. Am I right to be angry?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, even before that game yesterday, I'd actually written down in my notes for the podcast, in capital letters here, VAR everywhere. And that was including sort of Copa America and the other tournaments that have been going over the last few days. But then last night kind of really amplified it. And I know Barry will probably agree with me in this because I've seen kind of what you were talking about on social media last night, the fact that there is an issue with VAR here, but also Scotland did chuck away a 3-goal lead in the last 15 minutes. There's also an issue about that stoppage time situation, which is unexplainable. And I think the fact that referees are only learning, really starting to get to know VAR, you can see that. And I think the referee just panicked. She looked completely lost at the end of the game. Some players thought she'd blown the whistle. Some players didn't. Everyone was running around. It was just absolute chaos.
Barry.
I don't see what the fuss about VAR in this game is, because the decisions made using VAR were all correct. The problem is with the laws of the game, not the VAR system. I don't like it. I think increasing numbers of people who were advocating it from before it became a thing are becoming increasingly disillusioned with it. It's making a nonsense of the game, but those decisions were correct. Scotland have very little to complain about. They threw the game away, in my opinion. I haven't seen any of their supporters complaining about the fact that Leanne Crichton didn't get booked, let alone sent off for 3 bad tackles in the first half. Apparently that's okay. Those refereeing decisions were fine. The Argentinians were going in with some hefty challenges as well, but They blew this. Absolutely blew it. They were 3-0 up with 15 minutes to go and they couldn't win. And sorry, I have no sympathy for them whatsoever.
But even still, you know, football is about moments, and that is a great double save. And she is a millimetre off her line. And you're right, it isn't VAR, it's the laws. But the VAR has exposed that this law is... I was looking at famous quotes from Cicero this morning saying, you know, the more laws there are, the less justice there is. Producer Jonathan looks at me like I'm a twat, and that's fair enough. But still, there's no... Justice is important, isn't it? And it just felt so wrong.
Cicero may... Well, it's like being in a courtroom, you know. I don't, you get a lot of law, very little justice. But the rules are that the goalkeeper... is not allowed to come off her line. Whether you agree with the rule or not, that's the way it is.
I disagree with the law.
She was specifically told before the penalty was taken, stay on your line, and she didn't. So, tough.
Yeah, I basically agree with everything Baz just said. I think that there's something it's quite fundamental about VAR, VAR going on, which is... it's about how you choose to use it. I think there was a good point raised by Grant Wall, who's a US soccer sort of authority, on Twitter last night, where he was saying actually lots of test tournaments were used before running VAR in men's competitions in high level matches, whereas for women's football and for a lot of these referees, this is like their first exposure to VAR in the most important competition of all. So that is clumsy. I do think. To sort of flip it on you for a second, Max, as someone who's clearly very frustrated with it, I think if you were, imagine yourself if you were an Argentina fan and that penalty, which isn't initially given, there's no VAR and it's not given and you can see the replay of it, where it's a clear penalty, there's no discussion about it, you'd be absolutely livid. So I think that there's, even in this sort of mess, there was a clear evidence of what VAR can be good for. I do think that the problem with it, which is a real sort of core problem, is just how we are viewing it philosophically. Like, what is the purpose of it? And this sort of desire to use it, I think, because it can make certain things so clear-cut, like offside decisions and like whether or not someone stepped the line. That's something that you really can, unlike so much else in football, you can isolate it and go, is this thing right or wrong? There's a desire to use it in those contexts. And what's funny is we're learning that actually, kind of like you just hinted at, a lot of us think there should be a little bit of scope for shades of grey. Like, there should be a little bit, with the laws of the game themselves, there should be a little bit of scope for, okay, but a goalkeeper's momentum coming forward off the penalty spot, do we really care about that?
Goalkeepers are not permitted to stand in front or behind the line, right? Allowing the goalkeeper to have only one foot touching the goal line, or if jumping right in line with the goal line when the kick is taken is a more practical approach, it's easier to identify if both feet are not on the line.
Right, and this is... you know, this is the thing. That is how the law is written, and we're actually for the first time really applying it. What we're discovering is it's a totally unreasonable law. I mean, goalkeepers are basically never going to save penalties unless they kick right at them if they can't move a bit before the...
It's like match day two on the BBC. You just sort of fall sideways.
Right. But I also, you know, I totally agree with what both Flo and Baz were saying before. Like, a lot of this is not actually about VAR. Everyone's just going to point it and go, oh, VAR is terrible, it's awful. It's about the fact it's a law that we don't really like when we get into the detail of it. And it's poor application. I think what Flo was saying about the referee specifically, which just looked totally lost. I mean, the fact there wasn't an extra 5 minutes minimum of injury time at the end of that game is inexplicable. That's really, like, inexplicable.
The referee last night was a North Korean woman, I think, Ri Hyang-ok was her name. She's a former player. I like the way she let the game flow by not blowing up for foul. You could kind of tell she was a player and she was letting tackles a lot of refs might have got the card out for go. And I thought that was very good and helped add to the game as a spectacle. And a spectacle I really enjoyed. And I hope we're going to actually analyse the game at some point rather than just talk about refereeing decisions.
We should, but I will also say there have been some horrendous referees at the Men's World Cup as well. Let's not pretend there haven't been. Byron Moreno was sort of an international joke for years, and in that same World Cup, Spain had a goal disallowed where the ball had not even remotely gone out of play. So this is not, like, exclusive to this tournament by any stretch.
So why did Scotland blow it, and how did they blow it?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think they're gone out of the tournament because they have had a few bad decisions go against them, most notably in the first two games. But last night it was noticeable that their link-up play, their front three of Kim Little, Aaron Cuthbert and Claire Emsley, and Lisa Evans is in as well in midfield. They seem to link up a lot better in this game than they did in the previous two, and I think that's because Crichton was brought into midfield to sort of anchor that and let the others play further up the pitch. So in previous games, they were too far away from each other and they kept losing possession. They lost possession quite a lot last night, but that's what enabled them to get 3-0 up. I think the problem was then those players were getting very tired and their manager didn't make any substitutions until quite late in the game. And I think if she'd taken off a couple of those, brought on a defender and additional holding midfielder, then none of this would have been a problem. And I don't understand why she left it so late to make the substitutions. It just beggars belief. I don't know what kind of quality she has on the bench, but you know, it just seemed really weird to me.
Scotland were always going to struggle to get out of this group. England, Japan are, you know, much more developed nations football-wise. They've got more money to spend. They're much higher in the world rankings as well. So this is going to be always a tough group for Scotland. Argentina was the one game that they had to and could win. And Argentina have actually been a bit of a surprise package in this World Cup. I don't think anyone really expected them to get that draw against Japan. That was their first ever point at a World Cup. Pretty much most of their team aren't even professional. So this was quite a big step up for Scotland anyway. So I think last night they got off to such a good start. And maybe they were a little bit surprised. I don't know. They really went for it. I mean, the fact that you have four players there, really attacking players, means that you are going for it. And if you go 3-0 up, maybe, like Barry said, there should have been a decision to take one of those four off at least, because you still got four out and out, basically, attackers. Maybe Kim Little's more like an attacking hold midfielder, though. But you've got Evans, Cuthbert and Emsley, who can all just play up front, still on the pitch at 3-0. You've got to do something. The problem is that Scotland don't have a great depth compared to England. You see that. And Argentina made some really good subs. Menendez, who came on in the 60th minute, that was her debut. She was just all over the place and Scotland didn't know how to handle her. And I think that did play a part, is that they slightly didn't have a backup plan for when things weren't quite going their way.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, really, there was a point... Actually, because I was sort of flicking between the two games last night, because you don't get a sense necessarily when you're watching live that this monumental collapse is about to happen. So I actually went back and watched just the last sort of 25 minutes this morning on the iPlayer. And there was a point at 3-1 up where Scotland had like literally five players on the edge of the Argentina box from a break. There's three Argentina players there, and you think you've already allowed yourself to be outnumbered on the break, and you're 3-1 up. There's 15 minutes left in this game. You just don't need to have this many players forward. And I think that even beyond substitutions, there was just a bit of naivety. There was a little bit of like, actually, we don't need to score another goal. We just need to not do something stupid, which I think they, yeah.
Because the manager's, Shelley Kerr's come under quite a lot of criticism, hasn't he?
But she's come in for quite a lot of criticism from Hope Solo,
who I've started to think is just very controversial all the time. You know, like the first time I saw her as a pundit, I thought, oh, this is really exciting and interesting. And now I'm just not sure. She might be spot on.
I think she's good. I enjoy listening to her. I don't agree with everything she says. I don't watch enough women's football to know if her criticism of Shelley Kerr is unfair, but I thought Shelley Kerr dropped a bit of a bollock last night in not making substitutions earlier. I don't want to be too harsh on Scotland. They've done quite well at this tournament. They have been a bit unlucky, but they've also been a bit naive. But they will learn from that. One nice touch actually last night. Jenny Beattie scored their opening. Was it their opening goal or the second one?
Second
header from a wonderful cross from Caroline Weir, who had a good game. And her father, John, scored at the same end on the same pitch in 1987 when he blocked a kick from a French rugby player while playing for Scotland, caught the ball and went over and scored a try. So that was just a nice little bit of pub trivia there.
Slow.
And that's the thing. BT is and Corsi are Scotland's only two real strong defenders. Both the fullbacks positions, they are quite weak, and that's their biggest problem. But they will grow. They're getting more investment. And the next time they qualify for a major tournament, I think we'll see kind of a stronger performance. It's just most of their talents lie up front. So that's the biggest struggle for them.
This is a question, but I know Erin Cuthbert, after scoring, she sort of showed off a picture of herself. Was there any sort of further explanation of that afterwards?
So that's a picture of her, I believe, outside Ibrox as a kid. And her dad gave her that picture and said, kind of, remember this, remember your dream to play for Scotland. And when you get to the World Cup, like, this is just remember that little girl. So I think it was sort of a, I've scored, I've done it. Dad, you know, this is for me, this is for my dreams. And after the game, she did an interview and she said, I don't know who was interviewing her, but the interviewer said, you know, is there something you'd like to say to all the girls at home? And she said, just don't give up on your dreams. And she's a really mature player. She's only 20, but I've interviewed her a couple of times this season and she carries herself like she's 35. I mean, it's unreal. She was in tears on the pitch and you can understand why, because she is their star player and there was a lot of hype on her going into it. But for that interview, you never would have known, because she was so mature and she said, you know, we're obviously heartbroken, but this is football. This is what happens. And your dreams can be broken, but I've made my dreams at the World Cup. So
she did engage in some top house shithousery late in the game where I think the ball boy tried to put the ball back in and she just sort of kicked it off behind. And she got booked for it and just like basically smiled and said, yeah, yeah.
When you were away back in Ireland, Barry, did your dad give you an A3 picture of you, him and a cow as a boy for you to take out of your sock after a great live show to say, there it is, I've done it.
I've got it in my sock now.
Just in case you pull out a zinger.
Yeah, if I pull out a bon mot.
Right, so Scotland are out. Argentina could still get through as one of the fourth best third place teams, but only if other results go their way. England, though, 3 wins from 3. 2 goals for Ellen White in a 2-0 win over Japan. It's coming home, isn't it? I mean, 2 excellent finishes, Flo, but I mean, Japan could have easily got something out of this game. I thought England were getting deeper and deeper and deeper until they scored that second on the counter.
Yeah, it's been a strange one. Those 2 games in Nice and 2 second halves, which were quite sluggish, we look quite fatigued, and I'm hoping that's the weather and the humidity. We won't probably play in Nice again unless we end up in the third place playoff, so that's a good sign, is that we'll be in the slightly cooler parts of France. And I think that did play a part. I really preferred this team that played last night. Obviously, Phil Neville likes to rotate, but last night he was actually sort of playing a few people in more of their preferred positions, like Rachel Daly, who has been playing at right back for England, but she actually plays up front for her team in America, Houston Dash, and scores a ton of goals. And she was great last night. I think the main problem is that we were also, similar to Scotland, we had a lot of players going up front. We're basically playing with a kind of front four. Ellen White was sort of leading at the top. But then that meant as soon as we lost the ball, Kira Walsh was really getting swamped by the Japanese, a little bit in the first half and a lot in the second half. So as soon as she got a little bit overwhelmed, we've been playing weaker as opposition so far. So it's quite hard then when you've got better players hassling you for the ball and you're going to make mistakes. So I think that was the only issue, is that Scott and Walsh at sometimes are a little bit overwhelmed, and then the Japanese were turning over the ball in really deep areas for England and then creating chances straight away. Bardsley has had a great game. She made some really important saves. The issue there as well is that Neville likes to rotate even the keepers. So is Bardsley going to play in the next game? I don't know. As soon as I saw this team, I thought Phil Neville's going to have headaches, because this is a team that not a lot of people would have imagined him to play, but I think it's probably one of the strongest kind of formations. So he's now got to decide in the next game, which could be one of potentially 3 or 4 teams, how is he going to go for it? It's probably going to be a weaker kind of opposition. So maybe he can play with a really attacking side again.
I was really impressed with Rachel Daly, but I presume it's hard to get Daly in the same side as Nikita Paris, right?
That's the issue. And Bronze and Paris link up so well. I think the biggest thing for England is if teams know how to deal with Paris and Bronze, how do we switch this to the left? Because Toni Duggan is quite isolated on that left-hand side. She doesn't tend to play there for Barcelona. She'd probably be more central. And that's the biggest issue, is that if you have Duggan or Mead on the left-hand side, how do you bring them into the game when Bronze and Paris are sort of found out? But the Bronze and Paris link-up play is really impressive, but you can't do that every single game. And when you start to play the USA, the France, the Netherlands teams, they will work that out and they will just swamp you on that side.
Do you think Phil Neville has, like, in his head what he thinks is his first choice 11, or do you think it is, because he's sort of made this big, he's almost made it like a point of, like, everyone's involved, and that's part of the, I guess, having a nice spirit in the camp as well, which I think matters at all international tournaments. I've banged on about this on the pod before, but do you think that's something that when we get into the knockouts there is going to be a clear 11, or is it just that he genuinely doesn't have one starting 11 and is slightly mixing horses for courses for different opponents?
I think he's just really lucky as well. I think he probably does have an idea of, you know, this would probably be the best way to go. But I think he's realised how lucky he is, and there's such a big depth in that squad that, you know, Steph Houghton and Millie Bright are quite a concrete centre-back duo. And Bronze is always going to start. I mean, you know, she's one of the best right-backs in the world. So that's probably a dead cert. It's the midfield and the attacking essence that you never quite get. I think Ellen White is got to be the starter. She's actually scored 3 goals with her left foot, and she's a right-footed player. So the fact that she's being that confident and that strong means, I mean, I think she's got to start from now on.
And nerveless finishes as well, weren't they? They didn't try and power it, just both finishes were different, but perfectly executed.
Yeah, she's just such a physical player, and she has this presence about her which you don't see so much, I think, in the women's game, which is she's always on. You just never, even in training, when you watch her, clips of her training, she's just so kind of physical, and she's such an athlete that she will give, like, it sounds like a cliche, but she will give 150% even in a training session. Like, I imagine she's probably elbowing people out the way just to finish in a training session, and I think that really helps. And she's going to be going to Man City next season because Paris is heading to Lyon, so I think she'll be great for them as well. So last night, it'll be interesting who follows from that team on to the next round.
Because Stanway, I thought, was excellent. I mean, obviously, the ball for the first goal was exceptional. And she isn't guaranteed a place either, is she, really?
Not really. I mean, no. Apart from sort of probably Houghton, Bright and Bronze, everyone's place is kind of up for grabs. I mean, Jill Scott is probably going to be there as well because she's a bit of a rock in this team now, and she's so experienced. But last night, she wasn't as strong as she normally is. She's such a reliable player, but last night it was just so hard because Japan were getting really good at turning over that ball.
How well do England have to do for Phil Neville to come out with credit? Because I've seen really mixed reviews of how he's being viewed as a manager.
Is it how he's viewed as a manager or how he's viewed as a bloke? Because I think he rubs a lot of people up the wrong way. I don't know, there's a touch of the school nerd about him. I find him a fine fella, you know, I've no problem with him whatsoever. But I can see why, say, is it Jaap Stam and Peter Schmeichel and some of their Manchester, Roy Keane, might have found him and Gary a bit annoying. You know, what is it they call them? Busy bollocks or something. I can totally see that. I'd imagine he's a real nice guy. He's really enthusiastic. But I would say anything less than a semi-final appearance would be a failure, and even that might not be good enough.
I saw a stat that caught my eye anyway earlier on, which was that England have won now 7 of their last 8 Women's World Cup games, but before this one, but all by a single goal. This was like the first one since 2011 they've won by more than one goal. So there is that thing about the way they're playing at the moment. They're doing what they need to do, but this, I suppose, there's yet to be like a really, I guess, eye-catching performance in the same way as you got from USA have had, or even, you know, a bunch of other teams have had at this tournament. I think a semi-final like Baz seems to be the minimum expectation, really. But I guess at some point, maybe we'd like to see England really look great, I guess. I don't know. That's harsh, but
I think they'll be forced to outscore to run up a big score soon, because they're going to have to outscore teams like the Netherlands and like the USA, who will probably get at least two goals in a game. Yeah. So they're going to be forced to get more than a kind of a one goal lead. And I guess what they're proving right now is that, you know, you can grind out results and you don't necessarily need to make it kind of a big showy performance. Last night was probably the first time where I thought, okay, you know, these guys could really go on and win the competition, because the first two were tough and they were slightly ugly as well.
England could play one of five different teams in the next round. They'll need to wait until the group stages are over before finding out their opponents. Australia 4, Jamaica 1. 4 goals for Sam Kerr, goes joint top scorer with Alex Morgan in the tournament. The first Australian to score a hat-trick at a World Cup. Jamaica's defending was, I mean, not the best, was it? The fourth, it's an absolute calamity for their keeper, Nicole McClure. The first was a good header. How, Sam Kerr is arguably the most prominent footballer in Australia. If has Tim Cahill stopped playing now, he's just doing adverts.
I don't think he'll ever stop.
He's doing more promotions for airlines, I think. I'm not sure. But, I mean, she is a superstar in Australia, isn't she, Flo?
Yeah, no, she's huge, and she's got her own Nike campaign out there, and everybody loves her. So actually, she made her World Cup debut at 17 in 2011, but she hadn't scored a World Cup goal until this tournament. So it's actually been a long time coming for Kerr. This is probably the biggest stage for her now, because she'd always been kind of well known in the women's football world, but this is the first time where she can kind of announce herself to a global stage and to the world as well. And she has the benefit, unlike a lot of the England players, she gets to play in two domestic competitions just because of the way the calendar works. So she can play in the US for the NWSL and then also play in Australia for the W League. So she basically gets two leagues where she scores 20 plus goals to hone her craft. Whereas in England, obviously, we have a situation where our league is still quite small. So fixtures are quite spread out over a year. Sometimes you won't play a game for a month or so. So it's quite hard for a lot of our players to get a really good run of high-level competition, high-level games. Whereas for someone like Kerr, like, she's just playing at such a good level. The only issue for Australia is that their defence isn't so strong. So that's going to be their real...
Yeah, I mean, Jamaica scored their first ever goal at a World Cup, and it was similar to sort of the Thailand moment. This is a developing nation in women's football. Havana Solan scored it, and they were just so happy that they'd scored a goal. But they actually had chances to get a second, didn't they? I mean, Australia have not looked great in this tournament.
No. They do have some issues in defence, and they play a very high line. A lot of people have asked questions, oh, is it still a hangover from what happened with the issue with their manager, and this kind of rumour about poor culture and issues with the federation as well. But it seems like they have moved on from that. I saw them play in Australia in the Cup of Nations, which is sort of a new equivalent to the She Believes, and they won that, but the quality of opposition wasn't that strong, so it was quite easy for them. But they did score a lot of goals. But yeah, there is an issue with defence. I don't know if they'll get beyond the quarterfinals. And the fact that Jamaica were creating so many chances when other teams had kind of really sort of walked all over them is a bit of a concern.
Australia are the only game that's totally decided in the last round of 16. They play Norway on Saturday, and the winners will face the winner of England's first knockout match. Look at that. It's the draw is just opening up for England. They're going to make it, Barry. So exciting. In the other game in that group, Italy 0, Brazil 1. That wasn't a penalty. Someone tell me that wasn't a penalty, Paolo.
Well, I'm Italian, so obviously it wasn't a penalty. Clearly. I mean, look, this is... we can go round and round in circles on the arguments on that. It was actually... It was a fun game in patches, this. I thought there were sort of times when both teams were really open and enjoyable to watch. Then they both had periods when they got quite cagey. Outrageous front post flick from Dabinha in the first half.
It's a bit like that Zola volley, although it was on the bounce, but it was a bit like that goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was saved, so it might get lost otherwise. But yeah, it was a really nice moment. But I think Italy have... If we have this team has caught the attention back home. They've got sort of 7 million people in Italy tuned in for the Brazil game, which they've sort of contrasted that with, for instance, that's the same number, admittedly without an Italian team, but the same number that tuned in on another sort of free-to-air channel for the Champions League final. So it is really getting a lot of sort of excitement and good coverage back home, and I think with good cause, because they're going forwards. They're a really interesting team. Bonansea again really impressed me in this game, even though they didn't wind up getting a goal out of it. And their wide play, I've enjoyed watching them, and it's cool that people are getting behind them, and it sort of got celebrated on the front page of the Italian sports pages again that they managed to lose a game and win the group.
I think it's really exciting for Italian women's football. I mean, Paolo will probably be able to expand on that. But the fact that the women's Serie A isn't even a fully professional league yet, and the Italian women's team are doing this well, that everyone always thought they'd be stronger because this is the first World Cup they qualified for in a while, but they didn't realise they were going to be this good. And their team is mainly made up of Juve players. So it's really exciting, I think. Like, think how far this team is going to go once Serie A is a fully professional league. I think Italian women's football has got so much...
Is there a timescale for that? Is that?
I'm not 100% sure. Paolo, do you know?
I don't know about a timescale for fully professional league. What is happening, though, is that the big clubs are following Juventus' lead, and I mean, Juventus bought out an existing club,
right,
and incorporated it and then funded it to sort of accelerate the process of getting their women's program going. Did that a couple of years ago, and it's reaping rewards, and other clubs are following their lead on that. It's super interesting that it's Juventus for lots of reasons. Juventus right now are on the sort of the men's side of things are easily the richest and most lucrative club in Italy, and so they're able to do it. But it's interesting that if you go back through on the men's side, Italy's most successful World Cup squads, they've almost all, or not just World Cup squads, you know, international tournament squads, they've almost all had a core of Juventus players that has sort of been the backbone of it. There's this sort of hybrid word, Italiuve, that people made up to sort of, I don't know, reflect that concept. And yes, it's sort of, I don't know, perhaps predictable that it's happening in the same way on the women's side, because again, that's where the money has sort of flooded into the game. But it is definitely a good thing, I think, for the sport, for the women's sport in Italy, that someone has been willing to sort of take a lead on it and put the money into it. And I think it's led to a rising tide lifts all boats scenario somewhat.
Pretty even group then. Brazil beat Italy, who beat Australia, who beat Brazil. All three go through, and that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with France's win over Nigeria. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Unbon Bar says, can England beat India? Well, it was a very good game yesterday when New Zealand hung on against South Africa. We can't do it much on here, but The Spin is an excellent podcast. Barry, have you guest starred on The Spin yet?
No, I'm not on till the eve of Ireland's first test, which is against England at Lords in 24th of July. So I'm on the day before that to provide just a thorough preview and to assess the chances of both teams.
Oh, well, I'm excited. We'll be listening.
And then I'll be off to Lords the day after if they let me in.
Oh, are you going to wear a yellow and red jacket?
I'm going to wear a green suit, pig under one arm. Shillelagh in my hand. See how that goes down in the long room.
I think it'll be tremendous. So yeah, download The Spin. It's good. Right, in Group A.
It is interesting that I could go to Lords in a green suit with a pig under my arm and a shillelagh in hand and not be anywhere near the most ridiculous looking person there.
Group A. France beat Nigeria 1-0. Norway beat South Korea 2-1. Wendy Renard's penalty. It's interesting, Wendy Renard. It's sort of, after the first game, I thought, oh, well, here is the best player in the tournament. She's you know, sort of the poster girl of French football. She scored those goals and then scored a terrible own goal and missed this penalty. I was like, this isn't going right. Obviously, it was another one of those goalkeepers just off the line. It didn't even hit the target.
That annoyed me more, actually. Exactly that, what you just said. The fact that you still apply this rule when it's completely irrelevant to what happened, like when someone missed the target, I think is yeah.
Silly. It's worth noting, by the way, that it has been decided that this goalkeeper standing on the line will not be applied in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, that came out this morning. Is that, are you happy or sad about that? Because, I mean, it would make absolute chaos.
Beyond caring at this stage. VAR is an absolute shit show. I mean, it makes a mockery of the law. Either apply it or don't. You can't just like, oh, well, we won't apply that rule or that
I mean,
law.
I'm pleased, but you're totally right. I mean, it's totally ridiculous to go, this is a law we don't like. Yeah, They need to change that so you can have some sort of anticipation or 1 second law. They need to change the handball law.
Is the goalkeeper allowed to stand with one foot on the line and the other behind?
Yeah.
Because I noticed, sorry to go back to this, but after Lee Alexander, the Scotland goalkeeper last night, was pulled up for leaving her line and booked. When the penalty was retaken, she basically did nothing. She looked so confused, like, what? She kind of took two steps to one side.
I think she was worried that she would get sent off or something if she did anything wrong. That's what it seemed like. She did sort of just stand there and go, oh no.
The yellow card is ridiculous.
How ridiculous is the yellow card? Exactly. Like, terrible. Even if you sort of want to, if anyone wants to defend this rule, how are you explaining to me that that's a cautionable offence?
I know we shouldn't bang on about this, but you know, the other day I went onto YouTube to find... I just went through classic penalties to see if they should be retaken. Baggio's needs to be retaken in 94. You know, that's the first thing. Go back to 94 and retake that. I mean, because had the keeper not moved, he might have put that 20 yards lower and it could have gone in.
Don't, Max. I've seen more ridiculous things kick off in the Italian newspapers over the years. But,
Flo, does this France performance sort of bring them back down to earth a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny how things can change so quickly. I mean, yeah, after that first game and even that second game, everyone thought, wow, you know, it's just USA, France. Those are the ones you got to beat. And then suddenly everyone turned and said, no, France can be found out. It's fine. Don't worry about it. But I think it's just hard. I mean, you know, certain teams will be tough to break down. I think I felt really bad for Nigeria because I think they did so well. Mm. They did so well. And it's such a cruel way to go. But, you know, as Barry pointed out, that the rules are the rules. I think Paolo has a point there. It's ridiculous that if you don't even hit the target, you still get a second go. But I'm sure there's lots of people who'd say, oh, well, but her presence off the line influence, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, France are they're there for the taking for sure.
Well, Nigeria's still got a very good chance of going through now, haven't they?
Yeah, Nigeria's still got a good chance of getting through in the third place table. Brazil have qualified with 6 points. China have 4. Nigeria have got 3. Argentina 2. Chile and Cameroon don't have a point yet, but they've only played 2 games, so they could feasibly win their games. And then that could affect Nigeria depending on goal difference, etc.
Yeah, I think I saw a lot on Twitter yesterday, which is a really good point. And the whole 24-team tournament, it makes things really complicated. And it was probably a bigger issue in Canada when things are obviously very spread out because of the size of the country. But we have now teams who are kind of in limbo, who are sort of in a mini camp in various places across France because they don't know where if they have qualified or if they're just going home. And it's a really awkward situation. And obviously, we'll probably get to the point where FIFA will expand the tournament again because 2015 was the first time they had 24 teams.
And FIFA like to expand tournaments.
They do love to expand. So it's going to be a little bit complicated, like a 48-team Men's World Cup will be, where kind of working out who's going where, it just gets really confusing.
How good are Norway? 2 penalties for them, one for holding from a corner, one for a trip. Both penalties that I'm happy were given. They are allowed. What chance do you give them?
I think Norway are a strong team. They've got a couple of players who play in England. Maren Meldo plays for Chelsea. She's had a kind of stop-start season because she had this strange injury. And she's now kind of finding form again after coming into the last stages, playing for Chelsea in the Champions League. So I think, and they've also got Mara Torres' daughter who plays Chelsea defender. So they've got a really good team. They've got a few players who play in France as well. And I think that Aussie-Norway round of 16 game is going to be a cracker because those are two really good sides. And I think it could be fairly high scoring as well.
Because we've been talking about penalties so much, I did notice in this game that I think it's Kim Min-jung, the Korean keeper, on the second penalty, she actually sort of sidesteps across the line really well without leaving it. She doesn't quite save it. She gets down to it. But actually, in sort of contrast to everyone else who did come forward, like if you watch it, she
that's within, the new technique.
Within the realms of the laws, does move before it's, you know, before it's hit, but it's just sort of has anticipated correctly which side to go to and just goes to her right, I think it was, and doesn't leave the line. So yeah, so there's your template for making it possible, I guess.
South Africa 0, Germany 4. Germany 3 with a 100% record, yet to concede. The simple header from a corner for the first one. The second goal, I mean, the goalkeeping from Andile Dlamini. She'd made a couple of good saves later on in the game, but this one in just the middle of nowhere, a sort of simple ball across the box, was just hilariously bad, actually.
On the goalkeepers, I think it's interesting because there have been some really sort of calamitous things, but I also think there have been some... There've been some, including that Bardsley save for England. There's been some really, really good stuff as well. I think it's just it's more that it feels like the position at the pit on the pitch where you can sort of, and it's always true of goalkeepers anyway, but you sort of most see the difference between the good players and the bad ones in this tournament is the goalkeeping position. I thought another game in this group. I thought Peng Chimeng in that Spain China game made a couple of absolutely brilliant saves, really, really good saves. So
it was
I think
Chile keeper as well. Is it Endler had a fantastic game. Yeah.
And the Japanese keeper was good last night as well in the first half. She made some really good saves.
And the Argentina keeper against Scotland, despite leading in three, had a pretty good game.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, Paolo. I mean, that is a position where... And I don't know, I didn't spend a lot of time watching the previous World Cup. I presume you, Flo, have seen a huge improvement in the development of goalkeepers?
Yeah, and I think Carly Telford, who plays for Chelsea, it's interesting, obviously Emma Hayes has her point on it, and she's talked about it a lot in the press, and I completely respect her point. Carly Telford's kind of come out and done columns saying the opposite, saying, you know, this is the first few years of us being full-time, being able to train full-time as goalkeepers. And also Hope Solo, who we've kind of talked about her outspokenness, she made a point saying, you know, as the women's game becomes more professionalised, women will be scouted based on their size and positioned in that way. And the way I see it as well is, as humans continue to eat more and more food around the world that's pumped with hormones, and that's a separate TED talk for that one, but we will get bigger, you know. One of the academics who writes a lot about women's football, Professor Jean Williams, she made a point to say that the actual set goals for men's football were decided when the average man was 5'5". So those dimensions have been around for a very long time. There's also a big cost factor. If you were going to ask people around the world to change the size of goals, it's not a cheap thing to do. There's lots of elements, and I can understand why people are frustrated when, you know, someone does a shot from 25 yards and it just sails over someone's head. That is really frustrating and it's difficult. But keepers will get taller and keepers will get better. And the difference between 15 and 19 now is really good, and it's really impressive.
It's a good header from Alexandra Popp. Great name. Her first goal at the World Cup. How good is Popp?
She's really good. I think the biggest issue for Germany is they lost their star player who plays for Lyon, Xenofer Marazan. I think I pronounced it right, but she's got an interesting name to pronounce. But she broke her toe in the first game against China. She's definitely out for this whole group stage. The coach has said maybe she'll come back for the knockout games. It just depends. Obviously, it's a broken toe. I know Troy Deeney's done a lot of interviews where he says, yeah, I played with 8 broken toes and I just did it. But it's obviously quite important, your toe in your shoe in football. So I think a lot of how far Germany go will rely on the return of her, because she's just an incredible player.
In the China-Spain game, Spain pretty much had all the chances. China's keeper did play well. China have been in a slightly weird position in that they've known they were going through since Monday, but they won't find out where or who they're playing until 11 o'clock tonight. So they could be playing England in Valenciennes on Saturday, or Italy and Montpellier on Tuesday. Going into the same thing you were talking about, Flo, people sort of extending their hotels day by day. Spain will either play the US or Sweden, whoever comes out on top of Group F. China will face either Italy or England. Germany will play either Nigeria, Brazil or Argentina. Right, to the under-21 championship. England 1, France 2. Do we think VAR was correct to change that yellow card to a red for Hamza Chowdhury, Barry, as he flew in at 200 miles an hour and almost killed someone?
Oh, it was a red card, no two ways about it. And it's a shame. He's been incredibly apologetic scenes. A bit too apologetic, I think. I mean, it's only the under-21s. It's only a game of football.
I mean, it's a man's leg, I guess.
Yeah, well, I don't think he was apologetic towards... he did apologise to his opponent, but I meant more apologetic for letting everyone down, you know. I'm not sure people are going to be particularly upset with him, but losing a game more or less means you're out of the tournament, really. And
they were playing really well. I mean, I was really impressed with the speed of the movement, the front players... Foden obviously scored a brilliant goal. Damari Gray was... It looked like this sort of England DNA thing was starting to happen.
Oh, God.
Are you with me, Paolo?
I thought France were the better team.
Even before the red card? I know they'd missed one penalty.
Reasonably late.
What was it, 60-odd minutes? Yeah. 65? I'm so biased, it's depressing.
But but it was a brilliant goal from Foden. No, that was a good game. I don't say that like, oh, France were running all over England. I just, you know, I think that if England had won, France might have felt, oh, we played well enough to get something out of it. Certainly a pivotal moment when he gets that VAR upgrade.
Calamitous own goal from Wan-Bissaka at the end. A lot of chat after that game that, you know, he's not worth, not 60 million, he's not even worth a 1 million. It's not like social media to write up a player after.
He's clearly rubbish. Yeah. I mean, let's just ignore the season he's just had. And you're only as good as your last activity in a football match. And his was shanking the ball into his own net. Clown, useless.
We criticised Chelly Kerr for making substitutions late. Adey Boothroyd, Flo's got a lot of criticism for his tactical changes in this, bringing on Tammy Abraham and Dominic Calvert-Lewin to try and hold a lead and playing them wide did seem strange.
Yeah, I think I agree with Paolo. I think France are one of the best teams in this competition. England, because obviously we all are so aware of the Premier League, when you look at that squad, you think, wow, that is a really good group of players. A lot of people are playing in their first team for their club. But there are better teams in this tournament, and it's just a shame that England are in the same group as France. I think that was probably... Like, Phil Foden scored that goal well against the run of play, so I'm quite surprised that we even got that far.
Yeah, but I think England could have been two or three up in the first 25 minutes. Am I just totally blind?
I love that everyone's talking about this game, and Max is just like, he's watched a different game.
I was watching just waves and waves of England attacks, and, you know, they the post and Gray had two really great chances. That any of that happened? None of it happened at all. I fast forward to 8 years' time or 10 years' time when these guys were all wizened veterans losing another World Cup. Anyway,
probably be a Boreham Wood.
Probably right.
It is sort of fun, the contrast you got going on at the moment between this tournament and the Women's World Cup and also the Copa America, both of which have these sort of very forgiving group stages where basically, you know, as long as you're not the worst, you've got a good chance of getting through. But in the under-21s, it's like, mess one game up, that's it, you're done.
Yeah, tough. So Romania beat Croatia 4-1 in the same group. Austria won 2-0 against Serbia. Germany beat Denmark 3-1. Spain beat Belgium, and Poland beat Italy. Were you sad about that, Paolo?
I was a little bit sad, yeah. Italy have got this, again, like with the women's team, there's quite a lot of enthusiasm behind this under-21 team. Of course, the tournament's happening in Italy, so there's a reason for all that enthusiasm. And there was talk after they beat Spain in the first game of a return to 1990, we're hosting a tournament, the Notti Magica, the Magic Knights are here again. And actually, Italy, I mean, they absolutely dominated possession, had a crazy number of shots in this game, but managed to do all that without really creating many goal scoring chances other than Pellegrini hitting the post. And yeah, there's a lot of hype in Italy around this young generation. I mean, there's a lot of players in that team who people are really, really excited about. Moise Kean obviously came off the bench, is the guy who's at Juventus and who a lot of people saw in the Champions League briefly, and in a sort of big run in the spring for Juventus. Federico Chiesa, obviously son of Enrico, who's been fantastic at Fiorentina, and a lot of talk of him getting a very big money move this summer. And Nicola Barella in midfield, who was just brilliant for Cagliari and has already been playing for the senior team and running some games in the Euro qualifying. So again, a bit like with England, they're a team who have had a lot of excitement and hype poured into them, and this was very much a game they were expected to win. So there is disappointment about it.
In the Copa America, after a pretty straightforward victory in the first game. Brazil drew 0-0 with Venezuela. Three goals disallowed. I heard Tim Vickery saying that they really missed Neymar. Flo, you got some good quotes from the Venezuelan manager.
Yeah, Brazil had that draw, and they had three goals disallowed through VAR, and they were booed off the pitch. But after the match, Venezuela coach Rafael Dudamel said, "Long live VAR." So in the Copa America, it sounds like a lot of coaches are quite chuffed.
Colombia beat plucky South Americans Qatar 1-0. There's a lovely cross from James with the outside of his left foot. They always look good, an outside of a... Who's that guy who always scores? Quaresma, is it? With the outside of his right. Duván Zapata with the header. Peru beat Bolivia 3-1. Chile beat Japan 4-0. Alexis Sanchez scored a goal. Pseudo Berahino-like scenes for Sanchez. It was his first goal in any competition since scoring against Arsenal in the FA Cup.
Pseudo Berahino, I guess, might get a chance to score a goal in the AFCON Cup.
Yeah, for Burundi. Mm. Yeah, I've got the AFCON preview in just 1 second.
Way ahead of me.
Yeah, that was Sanchez's first goal since the 25th of January. Another game without a win as well for Argentina. They drew 1-1 with Paraguay.
Just to pick up on that, like, there's a... Because you know the last game Argentina in the group now is against Qatar.
Right.
And of course, as we just mentioned, it's quite a forgiving group stage scenario. But if Argentina fail to beat Qatar, that is the way they can exit this tournament. And Qatar, whatever we might think about them being there, about the fact they're hosting a tournament, they are actually not an awful football team right now. They played well in the first game against Paraguay. They are capable of making life difficult for certain.
Is it okay to... obviously dislike a lot that's happening in Qatar, yet still want them to win the Copa America?
Well, I mean, they swept all before them in the Asia Games. Yeah, I don't think they even conceded a goal. Mm. Or certainly didn't concede one up to the final, and possibly conceded one. But yeah, they're no mugs. And the Argentinians seem to be in total disarray.
Paolo, tell us about Lautaro Martinez. Plays for Inter, start up front with Messi, taking Aguero's spot.
Yeah, well, he's sort of was the guy who was thrust into the starting job when the Mauro Icardi situation hit full meltdown at Inter in the latter part of the season. I mean, obviously he was signed before that and was expected to take on a bigger role, but I would say until Icardi and the club fell out so dramatically, he was sort of more coming off the bench. I think this is my first season really watching him regularly, and I would say he... had some really encouraging moments. He's obviously a technical player, very gifted, but he, for me, was a bit intermittent, and I don't quite know what he is as a forward yet. He certainly isn't the same mould as Icardi, a real sort of number nine who is just thinking about goals. He does sort of come deeper and get involved in team play more. I think a lot of technical gifts, but yet to show me exactly what he is as a footballer, I think.
Time for the AFCON preview, Baz.
Oh, hurrah.
Here's some bullet points for you. It's in Egypt. Cameroon won the last one in Gabon. They were meant to host it this time. They had the tournament taken off them in November last year due to delays in the delivery of the infrastructure, rising problems with terrorism and the Anglophone crisis conflict in a disputed region to the west. It's like the Women's World Cup, 24 teams. Cut to 16 for the knockout stages.
Do you know who Cameroon's management team is?
Is it Irv Renard again?
No, it's Clarence Seedorf and Patrick Kluivert.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good. Thanks for helping with the preview.
You're very welcome.
Some of the big draws, Mo Salah, of course, playing in his home country. Sadio Mane for Senegal, Wilf Zaha, Serge Aurier for the Ivory Coast, Yannick Bolasie and Arthur Masuaku for DR Congo, Naby Keita for Guinea, Saido Berahino for Burundi. Egypt are the favourites. Senegal, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Ghana all in the mix.
Hey, Max.
Yeah?
Does your preview tell us about those three new exciting teams making their AFCON debuts?
Absolutely. Huh? Burundi, Mauritania and Madagascar.
Correct.
And that's the end of the AFCON preview.
I want to give a shout out to my in-laws because they're from Ghana.
Okay.
And I'm sure they would love Ghana to do well. I watched them lose, I think it was in the quarterfinals last AFCON, and now obviously we've moved to a summer edition, more teams, so it does have a bit of more of a spotlight. And Ghana have a really good squad. They've got obviously the Ayo brothers. They had this hilarious drama with Asmar Gyan, who was captain of the side. He was then had the captaincy withdrawn. He wrote a letter, an open letter, saying, "My mother always taught me that I should kind of accept these things." He said, "My mother once told me, you cannot tout a decision you did not take as betrayal because you have to expect it." And then he said, I still do not understand that statement anyway. So he announced his retirement from the team because he was had the captaincy taken away. Then the Ghana president wrote him a letter saying, "Please, Asmar Gyan, we love you so much, come back." So he's come back into the side. He isn't captain. Andre Ayew is. Jordan's also in the team. They've got Thomas Partey from Atletico Madrid. They've got Baba Rahman. They've got a really good squad, but they lost to Namibia in the warm-up, and they also drew 0-0 with South Africa. So they probably won't do that well, but I have hope.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we will round up any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. In my script, it says Flo soapbox time. It's very exciting, a debut to get a soapbox. I mean, Barry, you have a high horse, I guess, that you can get on any time. Flo, what do you want a soapbox about?
Well, a friend of mine who came on the pod a couple of months ago, Salon Andy Hickman, she works for a football charity, and I work for the charity Women in Sport. So my soapbox, I wanted to talk about a programme that we work on, which has a bit of a football feel. It's called Daughters and Dads, and we work with the EFL Trust, Fulham Football Club Foundation, Fatherhood Institute, and it's funded by Sport England. It's basically a programme taken from University of Newcastle in Australia. And what it does is it gets clues in the name, daughters, father figures active together. So we've got a few granddads in the programme, we've got a few dads. And it really works on getting girls those fundamental movement skills. And it also focuses on gender stereotypes. So the dads and the granddads will sit in the classroom and learn about the pinkification of the world and boys' toys and girls' toys and certain gender stereotypes that they might not necessarily be aware of. And then the girls will sort of learn about similar things, but in a slightly less intense and serious way. And then they'll get to go outside and have a bit of a run around, have a kick about, throw and catch the balls. And it's really great. And the biggest difference is probably the girls themselves, who just get 10 minutes to hang out with their dad because that's kind of all they care about. So we've been working on that for this year. And the idea is to expand it, have more football clubs involved within the EFL. So hopefully we'll go outside of London, get more clubs involved, and it will grow. And I think it's a really amazing programme because it's certainly making a difference to the dads, who are now realising, I probably need to spend a bit more time with my daughter, do a bit more of activity. And the daughters absolutely love it because they just get to hang out.
Is this going to make proper football fans really angry, like the Women's World Cup and coverage of same? If so, I'm wholeheartedly in favour of it.
I can imagine it probably will.
Yeah. I mean, there will be dads listening, I presume, who would like to know, can they get involved with it? How would they find out about this?
If they email info@womeninsport.org, and then if they are interested, then we'll know kind of potentially which clubs to target if we know where they're based, and say, oh, we've already got a pool of really interested dads, and we can say, you know, for example, say Stoke, we've had 10 people from your area want to get involved, and then you might be able to link it up. But yeah, we're working on the process now of the next stage.
And the same email address for people who are really angry about this as well.
Stop ramming it down our throats. Hey, oh, as an addendum, because yeah. I clamber briefly upon my high horse.
By all means.
Flo mentioned Ceylon Andy Hickman there, who was on the pod several months ago. I was recently walking down Brixton High Street, saw her emerge from a shop, said hello, hi Ceylon, and was completely blank.
Oh, well, that is outrageous.
That's showbiz.
Okay, is she allowed back on the pod? Or when she's on, will you blank her?
Yeah.
Paolo's Italian Corner. Yeah. I'm going to ask the question.
Flo's on a soapbox and Baz is on a high horse, and I don't know what I need to get on now.
You get a trattoria, I presume.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds all right.
Maurizio Sarri, how well will he do at Juventus, please?
I don't know. I'm as fascinated as everyone to find out. I thought Marcus spoke well to this on Monday's podcast. It's such a peculiar fit. On like an individual level, I think he is the Italian manager who deserves this sort of opportunity. I've said before, like I still think we sometimes forget how cool of a story this is, that he's a guy who was able to transition in midlife to become a football manager, and now he has the biggest job in Italy.
I have totally stolen those lines from you, Paolo, and preached them on many radio stations, saying, look, you misunderstand this. I really understand all this stuff, and I never credit you.
Well, that's, I expect it. But yeah, you know, this is a... this is the, you know, he's got the biggest job in Italy now, and I think he has done enough to earn it, and it also just doesn't make sense. He's such a almost like an outsider figure at a club that is so about like the slick presentation and the clean cut. We are the well marketed, like most professional club in Italy in terms of how we present ourselves commercially. We are all about winning, and this guy has only just won his first major tournament.
Are they going to get him a tailored shell suit?
It doesn't sort of feel like a natural fit. A lot of the fans really don't like it, but the thing which we forget very easily is that a lot of the fans hated the Max Allegri appointment. I mean, he was literally pelted with eggs when his car showed up for the first day at Juventus, and he went on to win five titles and four doubles and take them to two Champions League finals. I think it's very clear what's happened. Juventus have gone from a pragmatic manager who was willing to sort of chop and change to the thing that big clubs all say they want nowadays, which is someone who has a clear ideology, a clear sort of propositive way of playing the game that is his plan and that he's going to impose on other teams. And for all the stick he got at Chelsea, I think maybe even Lars might have mentioned this on Monday already, but yeah, this was still the team in the Premier League with the second most possession, the second most shots per game. They played an attacking brand of football, whether fans wanted to see it or not. But in many ways, the situation is like what it was at Chelsea. Are the fans at Juventus the sort of fans who are going to be impressed by that, or really do they only care about winning? And is he going to do the one thing which they need to do, which is win the Champions League? We are in year two of this already sort of small Cristiano Ronaldo window in which Juventus have openly stated they expect to try and win the Champions League. Is he the guy to do it? I don't know.
Is there a Jorginho already there?
To watch. I guess the obvious candidate is Pjanic. And what's interesting about that is Pjanic has sort of been moved forwards at Juventus to play behind the attack. And if he is to become a Jorginho, he'll go back to a deeper line.
And then is there a hole for Pogba to drop back in there?
Well, in that system, if you're going to play a 4-3-3, Pogba fits pretty nicely. He's a good box-to-box midfielder. I don't personally think that is a very likely transfer to come to fruition because of the financial realities of it on all sides. Like, I can't quite see it coming together. Juventus, despite being the richest club in Italy by some distance, they are pretty tied up because of the Ronaldo deal that they made in terms of what they can afford this summer. Perhaps if you move Paulo Dybala in the opposite direction, or if you can get a really good value on selling him, there might be more flexibility. But at the moment, at least they still have Higuain coming back with the second highest wage bill in Serie A as well. So they have a lot to contend with financially. And that's probably something that Sarri's going to have to think about right off the bat, is which players is he willing to let go of if he wants to get anything in.
Any more from your trattoria, Paolo?
Well, I think the big thing, there's a couple of things. I mean, quickly, Marco Giampaolo has now been confirmed after it was sort of widely presupposed as the Milan manager. I think that's a really interesting appointment. He's someone who's had a couple of nice jobs sort of later in his career at Empoli and Sampdoria. He's done well. And again, someone you think, oh, okay, deserves a bigger chance. Fascinated to see how he'll do at Milan. But the big story since Monday, I guess, in Italy is Francesco Totti resigning from his position as a director at Roma. Went out in, I guess you would imagine, the style that Totti would depart such a job in. Gave a 70-minute press conference in which he talked about this, compared it to being sort of stripped away from his mother, and said he wanted to, you know, he would always imagine he would sooner die than walk away from this club, and that it's just the end of his world, basically. Blamed it on an ownership which he said had given him this director's role, and then basically ignored him for 2 years, hadn't spoken to him about big decisions, had resisted his idea that he could become the director, technical director, and actually be involved in discussions about transfer policy. He said, of course, it's easy to say these things after the fact, but he said, if anyone had bothered to consult me, I would have said that Pastore was a terrible option for Roma this summer. He's someone who plays in a role that didn't exist in Di Francesco's team, which is true, and it was one of the more bizarre signings of the Monchi era. And And I think he feels like, yes, if the club had used him right, they could have relied on the fact that he's an extremely sort of well-connected person through being such a great footballer, and he could have done things for them that would help. And he's sort of suggested that he might well go on to do that sort of role for a different club, even potentially in Italy. So that is to be watched. There was this brief suggestion that came out of one of the Italian papers that Roma were so incensed by this 70-minute press conference that they were thinking of suing him, which Jim Palotta, the Roma owner, has quickly shot down and said that's the most ridiculous thing he's heard. But clearly, no love... well, I was going to say no love lost, really. No love ever established it from the way that Totti presented it between the American ownership and him. And following on from the mishandling of Daniele De Rossi's departure as a player, there is this sort of real sense at the moment of, I guess, the Romans at Roma leaving the club. And what mood does that create around the team? What does that do for the supporters, who, of course, are on the side of De Rossi and Totti? And, yeah, what does that do for the team going forward?
Thank you for your corner, Paolo. Birmingham City have sacked Gary Monk. I was going to say Gary Rabbit. That's a break. That's not breaking news. It's another Gary. He kept the club in the Championship in the face of a transfer embargo and a deduction of 9 points by the AFL for breaching FFP. So on the face of it, it seems total madness. The chief executive, Zhang Dong Ren, has done an interview with The Times where he says, "We gave Gary everything he wanted. There was only one thing that triggered this. I made it clear we did not want his agent involved in every single deal. I'm not 100% sure he was trying to get fired, but I know he didn't really care about this job. We only met once after the season finished. Last week, there were stories in the media that Gary would be leaving. He didn't even call. He didn't care. Maybe the problem is Gary. He's never managed a football club longer than two seasons. Every time he gets sacked, he gets richer. He was sacked by Middlesbrough, won his case and got compensation. Football management is crazy. Every time you get sacked, you get richer." A source close to Gary Monk has dismissed these allegations. Anyway, he's gone.
Is the source his agent, or is his agent allowed?
Who knows? Lee Bowyer isn't leaving Charlton, which is an interesting turnaround. He signed a one-year extension just hours after the club announced talks had broken down. The owner, Roland de Châtelet, he said, originally said he Bowyer feels like he should be paid like many other Championship managers. That the average Championship club makes a loss of around 15 million a year is not something players should care about. The owners are crazy. De Châtelet is trying to sell it. But they had some frantic talks afterwards. And Bowyer says, "We went on a real journey last season. The club came together, the players, the staff, the fans. We achieved something special. The journey hasn't finished yet. And I'm delighted this has all been agreed." In more serious news, a man has been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter by an unlawful act in relation to the death of the Argentine footballer Emiliano Sala. Obviously, he died in that plane crash in January, along with the pilot David Ibbotson. A spokesperson for Dorset Police said a 64-year-old man from North Yorkshire has been arrested and released while investigations continue. In Michel Platini news, he's been released by French anti-corruption investigators after being questioned over the awarding of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar. He was head of UEFA until being banned in 2015 for ethics breaches. He's always denied any wrongdoing. He said of his time in custody, "It was long, but considering the number of questions, it could only be long since I was asked about Euro 2016, the World Cup in Russia, the World Cup in Qatar, FIFA." Platini's lawyers clarified he'd not been arrested and had, quote, "expressed himself serenely and precisely, answering all the questions, including those on the conditions for the awarding of Euro 2016, and has provided useful explanations. He has nothing to do with this event, which doesn't concern him at all. He's absolutely confident about what's next." We will get Philippe on the pod when it is legally safe to do so. Mm. The Spain manager, Luis Enrique, stepped down for personal reasons, will be replaced by his assistant, Robert Moreno, after less than a year in charge. Paul Scholes has been fined £8,000 after admitting breaking Football Association rules. He placed 140 bets on football matches between 2015 and 2019. He's apologised. Said it was a mistake. "I wrongly believed that as long as there was no personal connection between me and any of the matches that I bet upon, there'd be no issue. Do you want to know how much he bet and what he made?"
I already know.
26 grand he bet, and he made a profit of almost £6,000.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about that story was that the morals, or the arbiters of all that is moral in the world, Paddy Power, who grassed him up to the FA. So I presume they're duty bound to do so. But yeah, if you're winning $5,000 on a Paddy Power account, you won't be long betting with them because they soon close it down.
Hey, fun transfer corner. PSG want to sell Neymar. Real Madrid might give him Casemiro in a sort of swap and money deal. Paolo, see it happening?
Don't know.
They could also do money and Danny Ceballos for Christian Eriksen. Barry, what do you think?
Sorry, I wasn't listening.
Good. Spurs might get Sampdoria defender. I know you love this bit. Joachim Andersen, 31.2 million from Sampdoria. Is he any good?
Yeah, he's good. He's a really promising young defender. I don't know what to say about the prices anymore. I mean, it's all abstract numbers to me, but he's a good player.
Flo, Andre Gomes to Everton, closing in on him. Can Everton do better than seventh, win the Everton Cup? Can they even do that?
Yeah, I think they would certainly growing into it maybe towards the end of the season. But I don't know. I've kind of almost forgotten about the Premier League in this point of time because I'm just so wrapped up in Women's World Cup and I haven't even thought that the EFL fixtures come out today and I just don't even want to think. I'm a QPR fan and I just can't even bear to think what is coming this season. So,
are you that positive? Yeah. And you got Mark Warburton, he's all right.
Yeah, so far he has signed three players that he worked with, I think, at Brentford. But it's just, I'm quite enjoying the break from the relentless fixture schedule that is the Championship. It's just a game every 4 days. It starts when your team are losing them, it starts to eat away at your soul a little bit.
You start away at Stoke. Tough place to go. Oof. Can you do it on a hot Saturday in August in Stoke? Mats Hummels has rejoined Dortmund from Bayern for 34 million. He's one of the players that Yogi Löw excommunicated from the German national side. João Felix to Atletico. A fee being negotiated, anything up to 120 million euro release clause. I watched him in the Nations League.
Absolutely rubbish.
A nice touch, a little bit spindly. That's what you get for 120 million these days.
No, I would imagine he's probably better than he showed on his debut for Portugal. But he certainly didn't do much there.
Rabiot possibly on his way to Juve, Paolo?
Yeah, it's a story that's run on and on, but it would be a classically. It's very much in keeping with Juventus' recent mode of business where they have done a shrewd job, I would say, of getting players in without paying transfer fee up front.
Yeah. Cannavaro, Pirlo, Pogba, Koeman, Kadira, Alves, yeah. Chan, Ramsey.
Some of those have wound up being pretty expensive when you actually look at the how much then winds up being paid in signing on fees and wages. But I still think more often than not, you're getting better value than you would if you were having to pay a transfer fee.
So I got very excited that Wes Houlihan is on trial at Cambridge United. But the truth has emerged that, I think I said on Monday, Cambridge United are on trial at Wes Houlihan.
I was just going to say, Wes Houlihan would not do a trial for Cambridge United.
He lives nearby and just wants to carry on playing
football. Cambridge are on trial with Wes Houlihan.
The manager, Colin Calderwood, worked with him at Norwich, I think, has basically said, there's, you know, they're sort of rolling out red carpet, you know, kicking rubbish underneath tables and chairs, trying to make it look presentable. Somehow pretend we're in League One or something. I don't know. Go on, Wes. It'll be fun. Just do it because it'll be fun. Nice place, Cambridge. Nice place to live. Very little crime. Nice architecture. Great history. All the things that Houlihan must want in a nice city. Ben writes, following on from Monday's discussion, I can confirm that Duckenfield Morrison's has a party shop selling helium balloons, cakes with your face on, and pyramids of Strongbow wrapped in cellophane. Also has a barista bar and cafe, and is the best and only place to snack in town. And this is from D Hill saying, the days of AC Jimbo would never have led me to skipping my gym session as I was too busy reading reviews of a Morrison's 200 miles away. The game's gone. It needs to be more serious, less enjoyable, bring in more VAR. Well, hopefully we've done enough VAR today. And that'll do. Flo, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. Paolo, cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.